Hello. My name is Dr. Mercurio Arborea, and I am the founder of the Arborea Institute. Through our unique blend of benign pharmacology, sensory therapy, and energy sculpting, we can guide you to a new, better, happier you. You are about to embark on a great journey. Let the new age of enlightenment begin.
What is at stake is more than one small country. It is a big idea, a new world order.
It's no longer a theory. What I'm about to say is fact. The secret organizations of the world power elite are no longer secret. They have planned and are now leading us into a one world communist government.
Welcome, useless eaters, to the Odd Man Out podcast, where we talk about hidden history, depolitical policy, occult deconstruction, economics, religion, and philosophy. I'm your rabbit hole aficionado, the Odd Man. Welcome.
The affirmative task we have now is to actually create a new world order.
Public policy could itself become the captain of a scientific, technological elite.
And when that first cocaine was smuggled in on a ship, it may as well have been a deadly bacteria so much as it hurt the body, the soul of our country. But take my word for it, this scourge will stop.
Welcome, oddities, to another The Odd Man Out podcast. Thank you once again for taking the time to hang out with me. I know you could be doing all kinds of other things, but instead you're here learning right along with me, and that really does mean a lot. So thank you. I just want to kind of help you guys understand things as I'm learning them myself. And hopefully it'll help us to all kind of navigate through the murky, wavy waters that we swim through on a daily basis. I've got so much information, current information, historical information. It's hard to know where to start. So I'll just go into my show notes. They're not really in any specific order. And we'll see where it leads us. I think it will lead us to something meaningful, some information that you can take with you and hopefully share with others. So let's get right to it. So I've been looking, of course, into those we don't speak of. The 16th episode in the series, right here, guys, and thank you for supporting it. I'm looking into a Jewish author, Bernard Lazar, who we've quoted from before. And this is a heavy quote, but I think we need to understand it. I think a lot of people are actually coming to realize that this is true, even though they've never heard this particular quote. They understand that there is a lot of truth to what I'm about to say. And so let's go get right into the quote. If this hostility, even aversion, had only been shown towards the Jews at one period and in one country, it would be easy to unravel the limited causes of this anger. But this race has been, on the contrary, an object of hatred to all the peoples among whom it has established itself. It must be, therefore, since the enemies of the Jews belong to the most diverse races, since they lived in countries very distant from each other, since they were ruled by very different laws, governed by opposite principles, since they had neither the same morals nor the same customs, since they were animated by unlike dispositions which did not permit them to judge of anything in the same way, it must be therefore that the general cause of anti-Semitism has always resided in Israel itself and not in those who have fought against Israel. Again, that is Jewish author Bernard Lazar. Now, let me comment on his quote there. I think we've talked about in the past how if you had a friend who had been kicked out of numerous bars or different establishments, eventually, you'd have to think it was his own fault, of course. And we're not supposed to think that of what they call modern Israel, but I think that common sense would lead us to believe otherwise if we could ever get away from all the division and the propaganda. and clear our minds. And I believe a lot of the reasons that they were kicked out of these other places are cultural, okay? It doesn't have anything to do with the way they looked. It doesn't have anything to do with this feeling of superiority in regards to the people who kicked them out. It's about their culture. It's about the Talmudic legalism, refusal to assimilate into the places that they were living and with the people they were living amongst. It's also about the usury and drowning people in debt. It's about the habit of so many of these Jews getting close to the ruling class, the kings, and whatnot. Naturally, the average people tend to look upon that as unfavorable. They start to have animosity towards people like that. You know, we have such simple explanations of everything that we're supposed to believe, you know. Everything's supposed to be so black and white in our politics, in our culture, in our social issues. But often things are much more complicated. Almost always things are much more complicated. And it's really insulting what we're supposed to believe, the news and history that's shoved down our throats constantly. But so many people have become accustomed to it. They've been conditioned to believe these things that they don't even ask questions. Questions that anyone, any thinking person should ask. And there's not a lot of healthy skepticism anymore. And you know, we talk about globalism and we talk about internationalism. Of course, Ford had the International Jew, you know, his writings on the Jews. And we've heard that internationalism, that term internationalist or internationalism, has been called anti-Semitic. Everything has been called anti-Semitic that you can possibly imagine. And, I mean, it's just a fact that conservatives and Zionists play the race card as much or more than any liberal on earth. So they have no room to talk because they do it all the time. Now we talk about metropolitanism, and I have a book actually called The Jews and Metropolitanism, and that's also considered anti-Semitic to call Jews metropolitan. Let's look a little bit at some of the quotes from this book. I think we can find some interesting stuff in there. This is by a Jewish author, by the way. This is with the turn of the millennium, cosmopolitanism, that intellectual tradition, culturally extolled but politically reviled in the European context between the 1800s and the 1850s, had come back into vogue. Cosmopolitanism is the new diaspora, indeed the new multiculturalism. It goes on to say that diaspora, we see this in reference to Jews all the time, literally means to exist in two spheres, suggesting that the diasporic subject has its roots elsewhere, whereas multiculturalism suggests the coexistence of different cultures and ethnicities. It goes on to say that all three concepts, diaspora, multiculturalism, and cosmopolitanism, are concerned with diversity. In contemporary theory, however, cosmopolitanism reflects more clearly the imagined crossing and mixing of cultures and ethnicities in the savvy environments of contemporary globalized cities, whereas the concepts of diaspora and multiculturalism more readily invoke notions of difference and separation. The cosmopolitan outlook means that in a world of global crisis and dangers produced by civilizational and international, us and them lose their validity, and a new cosmopolitanism, realism, becomes essential to survival. Goes on to say that, we see the notion of cosmopolitanism as arising at a historical moment and being shaped by its image of the Jew. Here, we agree that the late Benedict Anderson's now classic formulation that the concept of a nation was born in the age in which enlightenment and revolution were destroying the legitimacy of the divinely ordained hierarchical dynastic realm, coming to maturity at a stage of human history when even the most devout adherents of any universal religion were inescapably confronted with the living pluralism of such religions, and the allomorphism between each faith's ontological claims and territorial stretch, nations dream of being free, and if under God, directly so. The gauge and emblem of this freedom is the sovereign state. Now listen to this. Religious identity recedes in importance. Defining the nation state as the plurality of religions becomes more and more evident following the wars of religion, or at least by the early Enlightenment. Ironically, cosmopolitanism and the idea of the Jews become inexorably linked at this moment, as national identity, separate from religion, comes to define rootedness, and the Jews come to define its antithesis, the cosmopolitan. To go along with that, I saw a quote in a book called Synagogue of Satan, which is really hard to find now, but if you can find the PDF, definitely has some great quotes in there. I've been fact-checking them as I go, and I found all of them to be legitimate quotes. And this one short quote in here I had to check out. It says here, quote, "The League of Nations is a Jewish idea, and Jerusalem someday will become the capital of the world's peace," unquote. That was Dr. Naam Sokolow, chairman of the Zionist Executive Committee, at a special meeting of the Zionist Conference today. That was at the Carlsbad Conference. And that was from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, August 27th, 1922. It's also repeated in the New York Times and also repeated in jstor.org. And I'll leave those links in the show notes so you can verify it yourselves. But isn't that interesting? We know that there were a lot of people pushing for the League of Nations. That was the first modern attempt at a world governing body. And we know that there was a sect of Freemasons that were also pushing that. We know that there was a lot of these English types who were all about it. You know, they come out of the Rhodes Roundtables and the Society of the Elect and the Pilgrim Society and all that. We know what Cecil Rhodes said about wanting to create secret societies to control the world. And he, of course, wanted England to control the world, the Brits to control the world. But it's interesting that we see such a high-level Zionist say that the League of Nations was a Jewish idea. And that goes right along with the cosmopolitanism. We can also link the Fabian Society to the League of Nations as well, but that's a different show. And we see today that there's such a push for this kind of global governance. And the only way that they can do it is link certain states together, certain countries together, in, say, the EU or one of these other organizations, or through the UN, the United Nations, which was just a continuation of the League of Nations. And the United Nations, if people will remember, is the organization that basically, they were the final say in creating the modern state of Israel. So a lot of this stuff is connected. And the more you dig, the more you'll see some of the same people playing behind the scenes, and the money, you start to follow the money and the funding and the all these different organizations, and you see how a lot of these things happened so much differently than the way we were led to believe. Everything just happens by vote and by democracy. And all these tax-exempt organizations working behind the scenes and all these corporations, a lot of the corporations, in fact, fund the NGOs and the tax-exempt organizations that kind of work to write legislation and push legislation. So we really never had democracy. It's just a lie, because you can't have democracy when the people don't even know how things really get done. And we've also talked about, of course, just looking at Edward Bernays' book, Propaganda, shows you that they knew we didn't really have a democracy, because they were intending on controlling everyone through propaganda. So that's, of course, not democracy. That's not the people deciding. They don't even know what's really going on and how their minds are being molded. At this point, they should know how these things operate, but, I mean, average people are not savvy, and we know that. They're very tribal, and they don't think very deeply about anything.
This scenario is borne out by none other than Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, one of the founders of Israel. Recorded in an astonishing article in Look magazine, Ben-Gurion predicted that a one-world system presided over by Jerusalem will be set up in the near future. All continents will become united in a world alliance, at whose disposal will be an international police force. All armies will be abolished, and there will be no more war. In Jerusalem, the United Nations, a truly United Nations, will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of Mankind, to settle all controversies among the federated continents, as prophesied by Isaiah.
There's a very surprising series of letters between Kennedy and David Ben-Gurion, not only the Prime Minister, Premier of Israel, but the founder of Israel. They're very angry letters in which Kennedy is saying to Ben-Gurion, I'm killing myself trying to get a nuclear test ban treaty. I've even got De Gaulle on board, and that's impossible. And you keep testing in Dimona. You've got to stop. And Kennedy threatens him. And he threatens him in such a way that Ben-Gurion resigns. And I will tell you, forget Lyndon Johnson, forget the CIA, forget Fidel Castro. The Mossad killed Kennedy because they were so upset over what he did to Ben-Gurion.
Now, we just heard a video about an article from late Israeli PM David Ben-Gurion, socialist and secularist. You would think from that quote that he was religious, but he actually was not. Now, he talked about basically Israel being the headquarters of the New World Order. He didn't exactly call it that, but that's exactly what he meant. Now, at the end, we got kind of a bonus there with an author, one of the biographers of Kennedy, talking about how he believed that Kennedy was actually assassinated by the Mossad for trying to control David Ben-Gurion. Now, I figure while we're at it, because we did mention Cecil Rhodes, and a lot of these ideas that are still in play actually come from Cecil Rhodes. Where's the connection there with Zionism? Thank you. I'm glad you asked, and some of you already know the answer. The father of Zionism, Theodore Herzl, was a big fan of Cecil Rhodes and really liked what Rhodes had done in South Africa, in Rhodesia. And so he actually reached out to Cecil Rhodes for help in colonizing Palestine. And Cecil Rhodes turned him down. But regardless, Herzl formed many of his ideas on how to colonize Palestine on what Rhodes had done. Now, we know that Rhodes was partially funded by the Rothschilds and partially funded by the Crown and made a fortune for De Beers mining blood diamonds and blood gold. But you know that Cecil Rhodes had that series of wills, which we have talked about in the past, 6 or 7 wills, to leave his fortune. He was a very, very wealthy man. And he had meticulous instructions in these wills to form a secret society to basically take over the United States and eventually the world in the name of Britain. He wanted the world to be ran again and controlled by Britain. And so here is a quote from one of his wills. Why should we not form a secret society, but with one object, the furtherance of the British Empire and the bringing of the whole world under British rule for the recovery of the United States, for making the Anglo-Saxon race but one empire? What a dream, but yet it is probable. It is possible. Let's think about it. Out of Rhodes, he had the Society of the Elect, the Association of Helpers, he had the Pilgrim Society, you had, after that, and after Rhodes' passing, you had the Rhodes Roundtable Groups, you also had the Royal Institute of International Affairs, now called Chatham House, you had the American counterpart, the Council on Foreign Relations. Both of those are still extremely influential and heavily corporate-backed. You had offshoots in regional areas, the World Affairs Council, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, the Council of Councils. There's many of these offshoots that are local or regional. You could even say that the Trilateral Commission stemmed out of Cecil Rhodes' wills, because we know that David Rockefeller was the longtime chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he formed the Trilateral Commission with Zbigniew Brzezinski and others, other globalists. And we know that even after that, there were the Council of the Americas that David Rockefeller formed. We have the Bilderberg, one could say, could have even been possibly influenced by what Cecil Rhodes had done. Of course, you had the Rhodes Trust, which actually has quite a few different organizations underneath it. And you have the Rhodes Scholarships. Many famous people have been Rhodes Scholars, including Bill Clinton, of course, probably the most famous. But also you have the Swarzman Scholarships now, which are somewhat based on the Rhodes Scholarships. And check this out, Stephen A. Swartzman started the Blackstone Group, which was a subsidiary of BlackRock, and Swartzman is a Skull and Bones member. So isn't that interesting? You have this Crown Agency that started in 1833, the same year that Skull and Bones was founded at Yale. Not sure if there's a connection or not, but you have to think about these fraternities. That is something that one could say Cecil Rhodes had a big hand in by forming the Rhodes Scholarships. And we know that, of course, Rhodes was a Mason as well as most all important people who've been British in the last couple of hundred years or so. We could go back to our episode on the Square Mile in the Corporation City of London, which also is heavily connected to the Rothschilds and these foreign untraceable trusts. But anyway, I'm getting kind of sidetracked here. Let's listen to this quote about the Rhodes Roundtable groups, because you don't hear very much about the Rhodes Roundtable groups, and I think they're an important part of history.
The Roundtable is a secret society that was started around the turn of the 20th century by Freemason and Rothschild agent Lord Alfred Milner, who was entrusted the mission by Cecil Rhodes. When statesman and businessman Cecil Rhodes died in 1902, he was one of the wealthiest men in the world. In his will, Rhodes devoted his entire fortune to the creation of the Round Table Groups, the purpose of which would ultimately be to form a world government, or as he said in the will, to and for the establishment, promotion, and development of a secret society, the true aim and object whereof shall be for the extension of British rule throughout the world. Cecil Rhodes' strong desire for world government was epitomized in his statement, "I would annex the planets if I could." Dr. Carol Quigley wrote, "In the middle 1890s, Rhodes had a personal income of at least £1 million sterling a year, which he spent so freely for mysterious purposes that he was usually overdrawn on his account. Cecil Rhodes' commitment to a conspiracy to establish world government was set down in a series of wills described by Frank Edelet in his book American Rhodes Scholarships. Frank Edelet wrote, quote, "In 1888, Rhodes made his third will, leaving everything to Lord Rothschild, his financier in mining enterprises, with an accompanying letter enclosing the written matter discussed between us. The model for this proposed secret society was the Society of Jesus, though he mentions also the Masons. The secret society was organized on the conspiratorial pattern of circles within circles. Professor Quigley informs us that the central part of the secret society was established by March 1891 using Rhodes's money. The organization was run for Rothschild by Lord Alfred Milner. The Round Table worked behind the scenes at the highest levels of British government, influencing foreign policy and England's involvement and conduct of World War I. Dr. Quigley wrote, "The Rhodes Scholarships, which Clinton received, are known to everyone. What is not so widely known is that Rhodes, in five previous wills, left his fortune to form a secret society, which was to devote itself to the preservation and expansion of the British Empire. And what does not seem to be known to anyone is that this secret society continues to exist to this day. There does exist, and has existed for a generation, an international Anglophile network which operates, to some extent, in the way the radical right believes the communists act. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the Round Table Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and frequently does so." David Icke wrote, "Just like the ancient mystery schools, the Templars, Masons, Illuminati, or other secret societies, the Round Table groups were and are conducted in a pyramid structure, with the most knowledgeable kept at the peak, and each person down the line working on a need-to-know basis. Or as Rhodes discussed in his will, a succession of inner and outer circles. Jim Mars wrote, "The Round Tables started out as a collection of semi-secret groups, formed along the lines of the Illuminati and Freemasonry, with inner and outer circles, and a pyramid hierarchy. The inner circle was called the Circle of Initiates, or the Elect, while the outer circle was called the Association of Helpers. Two members of Rhodes' inner circle of initiates were British financiers Lord Victor Rothschild and Lord Milner." Dr. Carol Quigley wrote, "At the end of the war of 1914, it became clear that the organization of this system had to be greatly extended. The front organization, called the Royal Institute of International Affairs, had its nucleus in each area, the existing submerged roundtable group. In New York, it was known as the Council on Foreign Relations, and was a front for J.P. Morgan and Company." Gary Allen wrote, "Later, the plan was changed to create an ostensible autonomy because, quote, it seemed unwise to set up a single institute with branches. It had to be made to appear that the CFR in America and the RIIA in Britain were really independent bodies, lest the American public become aware the CFR was in fact a subsidiary of the Round Table Group and react in patriotic fury. This is the group which designed the United Nations, the first major successful step on the road to a world superstate. At least 47 CFR members were among the American delegates to the founding of the United Nations in San Francisco in 1945. Today, the CFR remains active in working toward its final goal of a government over all the world, a government which the insiders and their allies will control. The goal of the CFR is simply to abolish the United States with its constitutional guarantees of liberty, and they don't even try to hide it." Study number 7, published by the CFR on November 25th, 1959, openly advocates building a new international order, which must be responsive to world aspirations for peace and for social and economic change, an international order, including states labeling themselves as socialist or communist.
And we haven't talked about Cecil Rhodes in a while, and I thought it was good to revisit that whole thing because just like Theodore Herzl patterned his ideas of colonialism in Palestine on what Cecil Rhodes did, I believe that a lot of the modern Zionist ideas are also patterned after what Rhodes did. And if you'll look at, say, the Richie Sunak administration, the PM in Britain, his administration is filled with Zionists, just like Biden's is filled with Zionists, like Obama's, like Trump's, and like George W. Bush's. So they're really trying to bring things together. The video with Eric Dubé, it mentioned the Council on Foreign Relations. We talked about in the past how the year 2021, what a year it was with the lockdowns and the C-19. Well, you know, that was the 100th year celebration of the Council on Foreign Relations and Agenda 21, the United Nations. We know that all this is connected because so many Council on Foreign Relations members helped form the United Nations. So I think that all this stuff is very much connected. They're using a lot of these same ideas that Cecil Rhodes came up with in the 1800s, and they really thought they could pull it together faster than they have. And I think that it's only been because of the red tape and buffoonery of governments and the Constitution that they haven't been able to get things done as quickly as possible. But they are going for it. The Zionists are going for it. They've got their people in so many positions of influence and power. They're going for all of this censorship, whether it be Kristi Noem, the Trump administration, former Trump administration, the DeSantis administration, the Governor Abbott administration, or the Biden-Harris administration. You're seeing these so-called conservatives speak of free speech out of one side of their mouths, and then they're enacting censorship laws on the other. And we talked about that, I think, on the last show. And that plainly shows you that these conservatives are not on the people's side. They're up for sale to the highest bidder. They're sold out to Israel and the Israeli GovCorp. and there's nothing really that we can do about it except try and direct our money towards companies that have nothing to do with Israel. And they don't want us to even do that. Bibi has made threats about that, stopping boycotters and whatnot. They don't believe anyway in a free market. They want to force you to do business with whom they want you to do business with. They're cronies. So just about every aspect of conservatism is fake and gay, and it's just the way it is. They do not care about you. They'll give you some lip service, then sell you out immediately. And this has gone on and on and on and on to the point where they're just about as bad as the libs, but they'll lie to you and try and tell you they're your best friend. And I just wonder if more and more people won't start to see through this BS. It's like a spell has been cast over the people. It's kind of scary, really, to think about if Trump does get reelected, which I believe he probably will, what his fanboys and girls will put up with, because you've got this whole laundry list of bad appointments, really bad appointments, and things that he's supported, and they won't even acknowledge it. It's really scary because if you're standing outside the left-right paradigm and able to kind of see from a distance, you realize that us average people have nobody standing up for us. It's up to us to do it. You might have a Thomas Massey here or there, but how could one guy stand against the beast, the evil, this globally connected beast? It's just impossible. And, you know, Trump tried to, and we know Trump badmouthed Massey. Now he's kind of walked it back. We know the Zionists have been after Massey. So you see right there that these groups and these people are out to get anyone who really stands for America. They are not America first in any way. These people are America last. And I don't care how many red hats they wear and how many promises they make and how interesting and entertaining it is that they really give it to the shit libs. They're not on your side. They're not on my side. They're selling the country up the river. It's on its way down. Rome is falling. And, you know, I've been telling people for the last, I don't know, couple years or more that they probably just need to start getting ready for post-America instead of trying to save it. And that may be depressing to some people, but I think you need to start worrying about yourself and your family and your friends and maybe your local community, because I think that that's the only way you can kind of bring some goodness in. Because even at the state level, a lot of these reps, they're already captured. I know my local mayor, the Democrat mayor, she has been over to Israel with another gang of local mayors from, you know, local areas. And, you know, they're getting money from the Zionists. That's why they do this. Money makes the world go round. Money, the love of money, is the root of all evil. And we're just kidding ourselves if we believe otherwise. It always goes back to money. And I think if you learn to follow it, then you really will learn who rules over you and who these people are connected to. And again, one of the only weapons we have is whom we give our money to. And we really need to start looking deeper and deeper into that more than ever. When you have these people who only care about money, money is the only way to get to them. And that's really all we have. It probably be a good time to also quote Arnold Toynbee. We've talked about this in the past, but it's been a very long time. He was one of these state-approved historians in the British elite, and he said this pre-UN, pre-United Nations, but this was after the League of Nations. Quote, "We are at present working discreetly with all our might to wrest this mysterious force called sovereignty out of the clutches of the local nation-states of the world. All the time we are denying with our lips what we are doing with our hands, because to impugn the sovereignty of local nation-states of the world is still a heresy for which a statesman or publicist can perhaps not quite be burned at the stake, but certainly be ostracized or discredited." Unquote. Of course, this is a believer in creating a world governing body, and somehow that is better and less corrupt, more moral and more righteous than smaller sovereign states. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever, but if you're working for the elite and you know you're going to have a nice cushy place in the hierarchy of the elite, then you would also promote such things. So Toynbee was a very important figure. He was an agent, like I said, he was an official historian, very well respected, but very much a part of this Rhodes elite, this British elite that wanted to take over the world. So it goes right along with what Cecil Rhodes said in his wills. So I talked about the Council on Foreign Relations, and I think that people need to understand that the Council did start off as an Anglo-American organization, and it still is that to a degree. It's certainly the sister organization of Chatham House, or the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which is based in England, of course. But let's look a little bit at some of the people in the Council on Foreign Relations, and there's a lot of members. You have President Michael Froman, and Froman replaced longtime President Richard Haass. And both of these guys, you can guess, are Jewish. Chairman David M. Rubenstein, co-founder and chairman of the Carlyle Group. Carlyle Group going back to, well, Soros really gave them their break, and that is connected to Dick Cheney and so many other different neocons. Vice chairman and co-founder of Centerview Partners, Blair W. Efron. And you guessed it, also Jewish. And I couldn't find that in his wiki, so I did some digging, and it brought me to the Jewish Insider. And this is from 2020, November 3rd, 2020. Prominent Jewish donors among top Biden bundlers. Jeffrey Katzenberg, Mark Lazary, and Nikki Fried make the list of 800 of the biggest campaign fundraisers. Let's just read a piece or two of this, okay? Ahead of the election day, former Vice President Joe Biden's campaign released an extensive list of more than 800 of its biggest fundraisers who brought in $100,000 or more for the campaign, featuring a number of well-known figures in the Jewish community. The list includes Quibi founder, or Quibi, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Comcast lobbyist David Cohen, casino magnat Neil Blum, entrepreneur Paul Egerman, Milwaukee Bucks senior vice president Alex Lazary, philanthropist Lisa Pritzker, and lawyers Mark Donig and Mark Stanley. It says here, "I'm glad to help the campaign and end our collective nightmare," Stanley told the Jewish Insider. Investors Blair Efron, we just mentioned him, John Gray, Mark Lazary, Jonathan Levine, Jonathan Soros, Alan Leventhal, and Stephen Mandel, oh, and Bloomberg LP senior advisor Joshua Steiner, are also among Biden's top fundraisers. Michael Kemper, the CEO of public relations firm MWWPR, who is also on the list, says he's feeling confident about Biden's chances. "I've been a supporter of Joe Biden's for 40 years and truly believe that he is the best person for the job. Combined with the urgency of getting rid of Donald Trump, it was an obvious decision to fundraise for the campaign," Kemper told the JI. Numerous former Obama and Clinton administration officials, including former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, counterterrorism official Jared Bernstein, Ambassador Susan Levine, Secretary of Commerce Penny Pritzker, Deputy Secretary of State Tom Nides, ex-Import Bank Chairman Fred Hochberg, and Federal Trade Commission Chair John Leibowitz have also been key Biden supporters. Some of the most prominent Jewish members of Congress, including Senator Dianne Feinstein, Rep. Ted Deutch, Brad Snyder, Brad Sherman, and Jackie Speier, and former Rep. Steve Israel, are also on the list, as is Nikki Fried, Florida's agricultural commissioner and the only statewide elected Democrat. So I just thought I would show that there is prominent support in the Jewish community for Democrats, and we all know that. either way you go, you either get the liberal Jews, who are really bad in one sense of the term because they're so damn liberal. And then on the other side, you get the right-leaning Jews, like the ones who are aligned with Bibi, who are so far to the right that they are insane. So either way, you've got a lot of big money behind these campaigns, especially the presidential campaigns. Now, next on the board of the CFR, we have Jamie Miskik. She was the head of the CIA's Directorate of Intelligence. Okay, she is connected big time. She worked for Kissinger Associates and Lazard, and I'm not able to find her background, but obviously she is connected to those we don't speak of. It's just really interesting when you start to look at these different people. Let me see here. Let me look at her wiki for a second. It's tough to find some of these, and I think they're hidden purposely. Some of the background's very vague. It says here she was former president and vice chairman of Kissinger Associates in New York and currently CEO of Global Strategic Insights, a private consulting firm. She was also a member of CSIS, which is another war hawk alleged think tank. I think these think tanks actually write policies for the big companies, if you ask me. But let's see here if we can find any more information that might be relevant. She was the chair of the President's Intelligence Advisory Committee, 2014 to 2017. She was succeeded by Steve Feinberg, another those we don't speak of. So it just goes on and on and on. It's kind of silly at this point to even deny the fact that these people in this group, they flocked places and positions of power. Now, that was the top leadership in the CFR. That's the top four: Michael Froman, David Rubenstein, Blair W. Efron, and Jamie Miskik. Now, they have the board of directors, and we're not going to go through each one, but we'll just look at some of the last names here. Quickly, I scroll down to the bottom, and it says emeritus and honorary, Maurice Greenberg, Richard Haass, Carla A. Hills, and Robert E. Rubin. And three of those people, of course, are those we don't speak of. We'll look a little bit deeper at some of the other important members. Just kind of looking through their historical roster of directors and officers, I noticed that Paul M. Warburg was one of them from 1921 to 1932. You know, it's hard to take the time to look through so many of these. Walter Lippmann, famous author on propaganda, 1932 to 1937, also those we don't speak of. You know, some of the last names you can tell for sure without having to spend the time to look, but others you can't. Let's see, a W. Michael Blumenthal, 72 to 77, and then again, 79 to 84. Nicholas Katzenbach, 1975 to 86. Just for shits and giggles, we'll mention George Herbert Walker Bush, 77 to 79, not those we don't speak of. Henry Kissinger, 77 to 81. Alan Greenspan, 82 to 88. Another four shits and giggles, Richard B. Cheney, that's Dick Cheney, from 87 to 89, and then again from 93 to 95. William S. Cohen, 89 to 95. Wasn't he Secretary of State or something like that for the Clinton administration? I believe so. Maurice Greenberg, 92 to 2002, 2004 to 2009. Martin S. Feldstein, 98 to 2008, 2009, 2015. Now, we could go on and on. Robert Rubin again, 2000 to 2017. I believe Henry S. Bynum could be in the tribe. Anyway, you may say, well, this is ridiculous, but is it really? Richard Salmon, 2003 to 2013, 2014 to 2017. Of course, Madeleine K. Albright, 2013 2004 to 2014. We should probably mention again that Albright was the chairman of the National Democratic Institute until her death. That is an offshoot of NED, which is an offshoot of U.S. intelligence. You start looking through a lot of these names of these people who are currently serving, and you'll see that a lot of them have Goldman Sachs ties. Penny S. Pritzker, 2009 to 2013. When you start to look through the roster, especially of the current people, but even the past, and you realize you see Goldman Sachs, that's one of the main references you see, but a lot of the elite schools and all kinds of these big businesses. And you understand, especially once you look at the donors, all these big businesses who are donating to the Council on Foreign Relations and the Atlantic Council and whatnot. And despite what people say, like Scott Horton, who I do have a lot of respect for, it's not just a bunch of wise old graybeards coming together. It's something more nefarious than that. It's not an occult organization, in my estimation. I've never seen any. But it is a place where these brain trusts come together that are backed by these large corporations and banks. They write legislation. They write articles. They communicate with one another and kind of tell each other what they're thinking and what the plans are and really talk about long-term strategies. And it has a lot to do with foreign policy. And foreign policy is directly related to big money and trade. It's what it all boils down to is trade. Trade with the few, and you've got to be a part of these organizations to be in the club. So there probably really are circles within circles. I do believe that. And a lot of these people are just these Ivy League types that are really happy to be a part of the Council on Foreign Relations because it is something that is prestigious, seen as prestigious, even though they've backed a lot of these wars that have killed a lot of people and displaced a lot of people and injured a lot of people and disrupted the world. It's seen as prestigious to be a part of this group. So it's where all these people come together and a lot of things happen because of the legislation and the ideas that are put together at the Council on Foreign Relations and at Chatham House. And I'll remind people that there is something called the Chatham House Rules. Now, people like Amy Nelson, who wrote the book on the Council for National Policy, she's been a longtime member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and she says that everything's open in the Council on Foreign Relations, and you can see the roster and who belongs to it. This is true, but they still run on Chatham House rules, which is basically what happens at Chatham House stays at Chatham House. So you do get these articles, and you do see some of the ideas that they have, but there's obviously ideas that they don't give out to the public that come to fruition. So it's a very important place, despite what some people say. A very important place that's been influential now for over 100 years. And so I think that we need to understand that these kinds of places, people who seek power and seek influence, they flock to the Council on Foreign Relations and the Atlantic Council and CSIS and the Trilateral Commission and all the rest. And a lot of these people now happen to be members of the tribe, members of those we don't speak of. It's just the way it is. There was a series of books called Who Controls America by a guy, trying to remember his name now, William Domhoff maybe? And it's really interesting that he wrote that series. He was a liberal kind of guy, but he had really an eye for the Council on Foreign Relations and other think tanks, mainly the Council, though, and he exposed a lot of stuff about them. Now, I have found maybe the same website in archive.org. I think it is here that I was looking for. It's, yeah, Who Controls America? Who Controls the Think Tanks? Now, American Enterprise Institute, and this is a few years old, so I'm sure that there are different people in power now in different positions, but he's got Arthur C. Brooks, president of AEI, tribal member. David Gerson, vice president of AEI. He's got Strobe Talbot from the Brookings Institute. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He's not a member of the tribe, but his wife, Brooke Shearer is. Let's see here. It's saying that Brooke was a president of Brookings. Then we've got Carnegie Endowment, Jessica Tookman Matthews, member of the tribe, Paul Balaron, member of the tribe, executive vice president of the Carnegie Endowment, David Boaz, executive vice president of Cato, big libertarian guy, Robert A. Levy, chairman of the board of directors, Cato. We've got John J. Hamre, president and chief executive president and chief executive officer of CSIS, another one of these warmonger think tanks we mentioned earlier. Then we get to the council. Of course, he's got Robert E. Rubin and Richard Haass. This was before David Frohman took over for Haass a couple of years ago. Richard Salomon, we mentioned earlier. Now he's going to the Heritage Foundation. Let's see here. Edwin Fuhlner, Jr., Jewish spouse, Linda Claire Leventhal. So I guess he's not a member of the tribe. Philip Trulick, Jewish spouse, and Robleski, executive vice president and chief operating officer of the Heritage. Now we know that the Council for National Policy created the Heritage Foundation as kind of an offshoot of a kind of right-wing council on foreign relations, you know, kind of that network of things. Thomas A. Saunders III, he is a member of the tribe, and a chairman and board of trustees of Heritage. It goes down to the Rand Corp, which doesn't get talked about nearly enough. Michael D. Rich, executive vice president. Paul G. Kaminsky, chairman, board of trustees. You go down to Woodrow Wilson's International Center for Scholars. That's one that you see among the elites. Jane Harmon, member of the tribe. Michael Van Dusen for the Wilson Center, member of the tribe. He's executive vice president and chief operating officer. Also, Joseph B. Gildenhorn, chairman and board of trustees of the Wilson Center. You may think that this is petty of me to talk about this stuff, but just go on the Council on Foreign Relations website, CFR.org, go to the roster, and just start looking through the names. A lot of the names are very clear, and it's strange for such a small minority to have such a presence in this very influential organization, which is not just a mere think tank. And then there's all these other ones, and this is old. This is an older article, so I'm sure that the names have changed, but I'm sure it's very similar, maybe even more so. Because if you want to control foreign policy, especially if you have this idea that a certain people in a certain small state from the Middle East should rule the whole world one day, then you would want to be in these organizations that have a big influence on United States foreign policy. And you would want to have people in certain positions in the presidencies to be very influential and have your same ideas. People like, well, people like Mayorkas and people like Antony Blinken. I mean, you're connecting the dots here, and they're not really even that hard to connect, although sometimes you do have to look into the names and kind of follow the trail of crumbs. But there is obviously enough information, even on the surface level, to show you that there's this weird, weird drive to influence the world. And it's not just a coincidence. It's part of the culture. You could say it goes back to Tikkun Olam, which is really just part of average Jewish culture, even though it was created by a Kabbalist, Isaac Luria, with this idea of repairing the world. Now, if you think that repairing the world consists of the world being ran by you and your friends and your family and being ran in a certain area of the world, like the quote from David Ben-Gurion earlier about the one world government being run by he and his people from Jerusalem, then yeah, it all makes sense. So I'm just trying to help people put together a lot of these things that should be evident to people if they look past the first two or three layers of the news and of history. But a lot of people don't, and they don't even know where to start. And that's kind of what I wanted to do with this show and this episode. All right, guys, that wraps up this edition of The Odd Man Out. Thank you once again for sticking it out and hanging out with me the entire time. And hopefully you learned something you can take with you and share with others. This is a very controversial subject that I talk about in the Those We Don't Speak Of series. I say that it shouldn't be as controversial as it is, but it's just that way. That's the reality, and it's getting worse and worse as more and more reps push legislation, making it harder to even talk about. Now, I want to say, as I've said in many of these episodes, that certainly it's not all Jews that feel the way these people do that we've talked about today, that are seeking power over others and want to rule the entire world from Jerusalem. I often say that a lot of the propaganda and a lot of these ideologies have been pushed on average Jews themselves to kind of brainwash them and scare them and make them angry and easily controllable. So all those same tactics that are used on Americans and citizens of other countries are also used on Jews and have been for centuries and centuries now. You have to keep them thinking that the only people to save them is their government over in Israel, and sticking together and going along with what these leaders want is the only way to keep them safe, and they must beat everyone else or perish. So it's a lot of fear-mongering, a lot of mind control and psychological warfare that has been played on Jews as well. Remember, there's many citizens of Israel that have pushed back against the genocide and that have been pushing against Bibi Netanyahu and the baby bombers and the government that took over there 2 Januaries ago. So I hear that the protests are getting bigger and bigger over there, and they do not want that, and they do not want Jews here protesting what they are doing, which is a long-term plan, as you all know, for the greater Middle East, greater Israel. That being said, I want to thank my family over at alternatecurrentradio.com. Please get over there and check out all their fine podcasts and music shows as well. And thank you again to all my supporters and patriots. Love you guys so much. And I look forward to bringing you new information very soon. Cheers and blessings. And remember, their order is not our order. See you guys.
People have told me that the world hates me just because I'm Jewish. That one day they are going to come from me. And what am I going to do then? That's why there needs to be an Israel. But I hate to be the bearer of bad news. The only reason they're coming for us is because of Israel. It's because of 75 years of the Nakba, the oppression, dispossession, and dehumanization of the Palestinian people. Jews are at a pivotal time in history. We cannot let our traumas and our fears create a self-fulfilling prophecy that'll lead to our demise. How are we pretending that they are coming for us just because we are Jewish after we turn them into refugees and continue to murder them by the thousands? What will happen if this leads to World War III, causing economies to collapse and regimes to end? Who are they going to say caused it all? The Jews. We cannot continue to try to eradicate the Palestinian people and be safe in this world. And the sooner we figure that out, the safer the whole world will be, which may be why God spread us across the world in the first place and gave us the mission of being a light unto the nations, not to genocide them.